The title of this session is Defining Yourself, Touching Others. Today I'm going to conclude using the model that I've been using concerning the two basic needs of human life, the need to be separate and the need to be close. And the focus of the attention today is going to be on gender development and identity, based on the model that I've been presenting over the last six sessions. The two basic needs of human life, separateness and closeness. Today I've just used some different words. Self-assertion and recognition. I need to be able to assert myself as an agent, as a subject, and yet at the same time I need others to recognize me in my agency. If I destroy the other person and I become too assertive, I destroy myself because I still need others to recognize who I am. If, on the other hand, I recognize others to the exclusion of asserting myself, I also destroy myself because I give up my self-assertion in order to recognize other people or to do for others and rather than to do for myself. Now, this is very helpful in the sense of how we develop our sense of gender. Males and females all begin their sense of identity and sense of gender through the same agent or person, mother. But the process of gaining one's sense of identity or sexuality is different. The male is encouraged to be more self-assertive. The male gets his identity by disidentifying with mother. Mother is something other than I am. Not only does the male get identity by disidentifying with mother, the male also gets his sense of masculinity by disidentifying from mother. It's a different situation, however, with females. For the female gets her sense of gender and her femininity and her sense of who she is, her identity, in closeness or association or in mutual recognition with the mother. This is a different way for each sex to get a sense of who they are. What happens, though, with the male is that mother becomes less a subject and becomes more of an object. I can't be like her. So the male begins to objectify mother rather than relate to mother as a subject. Whereas for the female, it's subject to subject. So really what happens is the male over-adapts to one side of this tension, which is self-assertion. Whereas the female usually over-adapts to the opposite side of the tension, which is recognition. Now, as a result of this, the male gets identity and sexuality through discontinuity, breaking off the identity with the mother, whereas the female gets her identity and sense of gender through continuity. What we associate then with male characteristics happen because of the way the male or the female assert themselves or do not assert themselves. So we associate with male will, desire, activity, power, separateness, the outside world, what is different, excitement, and otherness. With the female, we associate passivity, an object of someone else's desire, not of her own desire. The sexy woman, her power is not in her sexiness, her power is not in her desire, her power is in her ability to evoke desire in somebody else. So this becomes a characteristic. Evoke desire in someone else. You know, use your womanly wiles. You know how to get him or get to him or whatever. So the female is into the position of attracting, of in the position of caring and holding. So these are traditionally some characteristics of male and female which develop out of one's interaction with mother to gain a sense of self. Any questions at this point? Inside all of us, there is this tension of how do I assert myself and how do I get the recognition that I need? We all have the tension within us, male and female. That's a part of who we are. The tension within us becomes the tension between us. The tension between self-assertion and recognition. My own personal feeling is that the tension must be maintained. When the tension is lost, we get gender polarity that I just expressed. And I believe that is what has happened in our world. That we now have gender polarity because this tension is not being maintained, it's being reduced. Males are adapting to one side, females are adapting to the other side. Okay? It's interesting to listen to language, and I've only become more aware of this recently. James Nelson talks about when a computer is working, it is said to be up. When a computer is not functioning, it is said to be down. Sexual language. Reference to a couple as a man and wife. See? Gender and role. Differentiation there. Not husband and wife, man and wife. Read about a hospital that would put announcements on the cribs of new infants. The female announcement always read, "It's a girl." The male announcement was, "I'm a boy." See? And I'm sure that you could find many, many more examples of that, where somehow or other, the female is not subject, but is object. Only males are subjects, and they have the right to treat the female as object. Males become more objectifying, more rationalistic, and that's because they see themselves as subject and they see the rest of the world as object, something to be acted upon, something to be penetrated, to be thrust into, or whatever. Okay. Now, what happens is, when one has this kind of psychic development, the male becomes primarily the sadist, and the female becomes primarily the masochist. One acts upon the other. The sadist says, "You will." The masochist says, "I can't." Okay. Then you get these relationships that are sadomasochistic, where really neither one are fulfilling their full destiny, but are acting out of dysfunctional, one dominating the other, and the other being submissive. As long as this tension or paradox is reduced, you get gender polarity, and you get domination and submission. Domination and submission is not built into genes. It's not built into life. It's built into the psyche. And our child-rearing practices continue it. Okay. Two, what happens when we get this male as subject and female as object, rather than male and female functioning in reciprocity, back and forth, mutuality. You get them operating in complementarity. One gives, the other refuses to accept. One pursues, and the other's less interested. One criticizes, and the other feels annihilated. And they're out of that complementarity, then, they lose their connection. They're going in opposite directions, rather than a reciprocity where they're focusing in on each other. And when you lose connection, then you get collusion. And what collusion is each one, unaware, substantiates the other's functioning position. One to be dominant, the other to be submissive, one to be pursuer, or one to be distancer. Now, domination has been typically attributed to the male side, self-assertion. Some individuals dominate and become so omnipotent that they annihilate anyone else's self-assertion. You know, when you think about it, destruction of another is a way to get your sense of differentiation. You know, it makes sense, I mean, psychologically, it makes sense in terms of murder, gossip, destruction of another person, robbing them of their personhood. Because when I deny it to you, I get it for myself. And destruction, perhaps, is the most perverse form of distancing, of getting one's sense of differentiation from others. Now, one of the most perverse forms of this side, the passive side, is to totally become a victim, of to be totally submissive, where one has no capacity to be self-assertive, that one is without any will or without any desire, without any power. Okay, now I'm going to talk a little bit more about the development of masculinity and femininity. The male recognizes early in life that I cannot be mother because she is other than myself. The only thing is I can have her. And out of that thinking then, the child also develops a sense that mother is nothing but an object, not a subject. And males then have this sense of treating others as objects, not necessarily as subjects. Mother is not a subject. Mother is an object. That's a failure in recognition. It's a failure that I'd still need mother to recognize me in order for me to maintain my subjectivity. All right, let me just stop here for a second, take some questions from anybody. Yes?
I want to make sure I understood your point about tension and polarity.
Yes.
Are you saying that people, both men and women, do not maintain the tension within them because of the polarity of their roles?
Because it's difficult to maintain two things at one time. So it's difficult to maintain these two things within us, and it's difficult to maintain it between us. It's the tension. I'm saying the tension is necessary for wholeness. Take away contradiction, take away tension, take away paradox, and I believe you don't have wholeness.
Both in relationship and...
and within self. Most people think wholeness is convergence, harmony, where there is no difference. My feeling is wholeness is when two things can be held together in tension. And later on, I'm going to talk to you about the difference between analogical thinking and dialectical thinking, and I'll say more about that.
So that true kind of healthy tension between men and women is when both, all those qualities are in each. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes. Now, as it may be that females today need to learn more self-assertion. And males need to learn more recognition, generally. That may not be a particular situation for any individual. But whatever it is, I have to be able to both be assertive and to recognize to be whole. Yes.
Now, is this self-assertion and recognition with the mother basically because of the mother's biology?
Biology.
Is it because she is female and has different body parts? Or is it because of the societal concept?
Okay, you're asking a good question that doesn't have an answer, and there are lots of theories. I decided not to give you all the different theories because I thought we'd get off onto that. I just wanted to give you the basic body. But, for instance, Freud's concept of penis envy is really explained here, that the female is passive, does not have her own desire, and therefore desires the male penis to have this sense of desire. Now, this can be as much mental and representative and symbolic as actual, that the male represents this mentally and active, so forth. Okay. For instance, they watch men play with children, and men jiggle and thrust the child. It's more vigorous play activity. Females in playing with them is more smoothing, comforting. Different styles of play. Now, nobody sat down and gave each male and female different ways to do it. There is something there, biologically, where male is into more motor activity. Okay. And they find that infants find that dad's play very exciting, very enticing. Point is, we need exciting play, and we also need comforting, soothing play. Not one or the other. For wholeness, that's what I'm saying. Is the soothing one. Could do that. Could take that function, right. Could take that function, correct. You know, it's going to be interesting what is going to happen when you have males participating more in the nurturing in the future. It may be that the gap that's existed here is going to close more. See, I talk to career women, and I say, you know, the thing that you should not do is become like a man. But they all wear suits, blouses, and ties. You know, why should the career woman become more like a man? That's all you're doing is saying that I'm going to become more self-assertive, at least in my dress or in some style. I don't think you have to give up this side to be this side. It's the tension again. Okay? Yes? Subject means I have agency, I have a will, I act. I can affect things and influence things. Like, I love you. I is the subject. Right? You is the object. An action. Somebody's been acted upon by the agent. Okay? Anybody else here? Yes.
In answer to his question, could subject and object be compared with the subject and the object of a sentence in grammar?
Yes.
The doer of the action or the receiver of the action?
Correct. Mm-hmm. My point is to say is, for wholeness, I have to be both subject and object. I have to be able to act upon, and I also have to be able to be acted upon. Traditionally, if we go into what I've been talking about here, the gender polarity, the male has been the actor upon, the female has been the one who's been acted upon. And then what happens, you see, if these are two basic needs in life, what happens, for instance, for the male who has the need for recognition? Where does it go? Becomes repressed. And for the female, where does the self-assertion go? Becomes repressed. There's another truism that we use in psychology. It says, whatever you alienate, disavow, disown, or you might even want to say, repress, cut off as your own, you project. So if you don't like your anger, what do you do with it? You project it onto somebody else. Somebody else is angry. Yes?
There's a line of thinking that about the male disidentifying with the mother, that in some way that doesn't work to give a true sense of identity, and that in the men, especially in what you're talking about, the kinds of violence and the urge to dominate, are still trying to get their sense of self-assertion, that it's not a true sense of self-assertion, and that there's a basic terror that operate with men because they know they're not of the mother and part of the creative force that the mother represents, but they don't really know in today's society quite what they are. I just wonder how...
I would agree with that in part, and again, when you talk about men in general, it's difficult because we've got a spectrum, but generally, men over-differentiate, over-self-assert, and become fearful of females because females represent dependency, vulnerability. And all of the messages the male gets is to be what? To be a subject, to express one's will, to have desire. Now, men can be threatened when women begin to express their will and their desire. To have suffrage, to have equal opportunity, to have equal pay. Because psychologically, that's not the way they learned it. The way they learned it was they should not have desire, they should not have will, they should stay in the kitchen. I'll tell you, some gender polarity that happened in our family just a month ago. We were preparing to go to Wichita Falls, Texas for my niece's wedding. And my wife and I had to leave on Friday, so I would be there for the wedding rehearsal since I was preaching at the wedding. My two daughters had come home from Chicago. My two daughters and my oldest daughter's boyfriend and two sons were going to drive up the next day. And my youngest daughter was going to do the driving. But my oldest daughter's boyfriend, I took him aside and gave him the gas cards, and I said to him, here's the direction on how to get there. My 21-year-old daughter said, I am very angry when things like this happen. I have just spent 6 months in Europe traveling, sometimes on my own, finding my way around. Well, I have enough self-assertion and sense of self to say, you're right, and I want to affirm that. And what I just did was wrong. See? And I took the cards and the map, and I sat down and talked with her. I mean, we got to learn. You got to give us a chance. Yeah, sure. I even said he the other night in my sermon. Nobody caught it, and I was thinking, so what? You know, I was preaching against the law of achievement. You know, you got to give a little room for failure. But that was a place, the way I learned, see. And it was just, well, what would you do in my family of origin? You would have the male drive the car and give him the credit card and so on, and just playing through that unconsciously until someone made me aware of what was going on. That she could have will, she could have activity, she could have this eye. Okay? Any other comments or questions before I go on? Okay, now, one of the keys is that we like to reduce paradoxes. We don't like to live with tension. And so we then tend to take care of the tension by over-adapting to one side or the other. And that's what I'm explaining here in gender polarity. There are two basic ways that we know. One is analogically, and one is dialectically. Analogical thinking is based on like seeks like. Dialectical thinking is based upon I know something only in its opposite. I know the sound of night because I know the silence of night. I know despair because I have known joy. I know something in its opposite. That's dialectical knowing. Analogical is like seeks like. So this is based on correspondence, resemblance. Here we got contradiction. attention. Now, this is very important and very necessary in life. For instance, when you come to a traffic light and the light is changing from green to yellow, you don't really want to be in dialectical thought. You want to be thinking analogically. Okay, well, I better stop when it gets red because that's what you do and that resembles what I did in the past. Well, this is the scientific system. This is pure rationality, etc., etc. We need this kind of thinking. It's appropriate in places. But to understand and to deal with the deeper things of life, we need to be able to think dialectically. Without contraries, William Blake said, there is no progress. Without the tension, without the progress, there is no growth. There is no movement. I need to deal with the dialectic. Dialego means to talk through something. Two things are in tension. They don't get resolved, but they're in tension. They're both and, even though they seem like opposites, to get to the deeper things of life. Now, this is very difficult kind of thinking, because we know from Piaget that it's not until about the age of 14 to 17 that we move from what is called concrete thinking to formal thinking. Concrete thinking is a bird is a bird is a bird, a rose is a rose is a rose. It's literal thinking. Formal thinking is the ability to think about your thoughts, to see things in relationships, to be able to use syllogism, to see things in parallel. In other words, to hold two thoughts at one time. That doesn't develop till about 14 or 17. Unfortunately, for some people, it doesn't develop. Most people, by the way, if you look at the bell curve, stay at the third stage of cognitive development, which is very literalistic. And it's not really until you get to about the age 30 that you can really deal with dialectical thinking. Now, some can earlier, but it begins to develop around the age 30. That's why somebody wrote an article not too long ago, I don't think someone can become a Lutheran until they age 30. Because Lutheran theology is dialectic. Luther operated in university and was very used to that kind of thought. But the ability to hold two things together developmentally doesn't take place till here. That's why confirmation class, by the way, the best you can do with 12 and 13-year-olds is teach them facts, because they're into concrete thinking. You can't teach them about deeper meanings, not until they get to this particular stage of development, 14 to 17 or whatever. And dialectical thinking really is fourth and fifth stage thinking cognitively, higher development of our ability to think about things. But that develops a lot later. So if we have most of the population at third level, it makes sense that we're going to have a lot of gender polarity, because folks tend to reduce tensions. It's difficult to keep two thoughts together at one time. Most folks then will deal with gender issues from an analogical point of view. Like seeks like. This is what men are like, and that's the way it is. That's the way nature demanded it. That's the way the world is. Or about, etc. That's the easiest way to deal with the tension, is to use analogical thought. Question?
Now, maybe I'm missing it, but I'm having a little bit of, I'm kind of starting to attempt to confuse dialectic with self-assertion and analogical? I can't read.
Analogical.
Analogical with subject-subject.
No, dialectical would include self-assertion and recognition. Take the tension and hold them together. Analogical would say you keep these two apart. You know, analogical would say, well, that's just like a woman. You know? You've seen one woman, you've seen them all. That's
wouldn't self-assertive thinking kind of push you towards dialectic thinking where there are things different?
No, that would not. That's because this is more psychological. This is more cognitive.
Okay.
Yeah. And until I get to a certain cognitive level, I cannot keep two things in tension. See, that's what becomes so perplexing for a child. It's when a child begins to deal with these two opposing psychic forces, it's extremely difficult. The child always tries to reduce the tension. And the way the child does that is to split. Splitting is the most primitive defense mechanism we know of. And the child, for instance, will split oneself. Me, and there's the bad me. Okay? And then we'll split the mother. There's the good mother, and then there's the bad mother. There's the witch and the doll. Okay. And the splitting then is a defense so that I don't have to deal with the tensions. That's prior to repression. Repression comes later when the cognitive capacities and memory take place. Then you can forget what you forgot, because that's what repression is, to forget what you forgot. Okay. All right?
So there doesn't seem to be any gender differences in terms of being able to develop this dialectic thinking?
Say that again, so I want to be sure.
Any difference between males and females in ability to...
Oh, to think one way or the other?
Right.
Now, there may be that I'm not aware of, but I don't think it's gender determined. I think it would be more genetic. It may be that there may be more females that can do dialectical thinking than males. Males may be able to do more analytical. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Okay. Any other questions on this? The capacity of how we see. Yes.
Where does the father
fit in all this? Okay. The father, as most people have said, represents separateness for the most part. He is other than mother. He represents the outside world. He represents will and desire. He represents activity. Okay. He represents the self-assertion side.
The children don't identify with him. Like
with, well, yes, they do and they don't. But again, I have to go into a whole lot of Freudian psychology to give you one aspect, and I have to go into some more of the feminist view, and I don't want to get off on that if I can help it. How do I deal with this? So I give you a satisfactory answer. Father does play an important role, and the best I can say is he generally represents this side, self-assertion.
Okay. How about an absent father? Through death or divorce where he is gone completely?
Yeah. And that creates a difficulty because it doesn't provide for the child someone who is other, separate. Now, some children are able to make up for that deficit by finding a teacher, male teacher, or an uncle, or an older brother, or some other male figure for that mental representation. And some don't have it. It'd be an interesting study to see if male children raised predominantly by mother have lots of problems over here in self-assertion. I don't know. Or become too assertive to make up for the gap of not really having a good sense of it. I don't know. Yes, it would. It would, yes. Because there's that also sense of the outside world, that which is other than mother, comes through the father. Correct. And she may be, later on in life, you know, constantly looking for the father, looking for someone to fill that role. there are so many theories today. Once you just take this basic outline, then you go to the theories to explain it all. I just don't have time to do all that. To do justice, I have to talk about Carol Gilligan and Nancy Cotterow, and then I go over here to some of the other folks on the male side. Okay. Right now, I want to say is that I see the gender issue being somewhat similar to the whole issue I talked about to begin with, that we have this tension that we're always living in, and that's the need to be separate and the need to be close, and they're obviously opposite. And we tend to reduce that tension. I don't like closeness, so I go into strong distancing. I'm fearful of separateness, so I go into strong fusion with somebody else. I go push to the extremes. That's to reduce the tension here. And I believe where you have the strongest gender polarity, it's people who are fearful of this tension. People who are fearful of one side or the other. We do know in the most gendered families, where the old stereotype of the male being dominant and so forth and female submissive, these are the families that are most violent and most incestuous. Well, it makes sense. Because male represents what? Will, desire, domination, activity. So the more you push to the extreme, the more you also push for perversity and distortion. Hand back here. Yes.
I didn't hear what second word you said, what adjective you used after. Was it possessive or the most dominated child, either by male or female, or the most what? You gave two words, and I didn't get the second one.
Incestuous, violent, and incestuous.
Okay.
Yeah. Where people's sense of separateness and boundaries are violated. And what is very fascinating is that when you get into those situations where family, where individuals' boundaries are violated, the child needs a parent that's perfect. A child can't live with a bad parent. The parent is that powerful. So the child splits off the parent into good and bad. You see, abused children are powerfully bonded to their abuser. They repress the bad father, the abuser, they idealize the good father. Even if it's just a little goodness, but somehow they'll build up some kind of idealization or fantasy that the father is good. That's a defense mechanism. Because a child cannot live with imperfect bad parenting. The parent needs to be good, healthy, strong, powerful. So if it isn't true in actuality, the child goes to fantasy to make it that way. Well, it's still a split, that there is no good. So the way I handle with the abuser is all bad. And that's reducing the tension.
Is that also why the child takes on blame?
Yeah, child sucks in the blame, because I cannot blame the parent or the strong one, because I need them to be strong. So I will take the blame inside myself. Boy, there's so many adults that I work with that have this self-blame that they've developed out of childhood. Who else do you blame? See? There's no place to put it out there. Now, some children do learn to put it out there and not to put it inside, but most children take it and put it inside. And that's where a lot of our low self-worth, low self-esteem, poor self-image, all of that begins to develop when you're turning all the stuff inside, turning the sword in on yourself and blaming yourself. Just a little word about a phrase called the fantasy bond. And there's a book called The Fantasy Bond by a man named Robert Firestone, in which he says the most emotionally deprived and abandoned children cling to and idealize their family or their parents. It could be the family, too. Because children from 0 to 8 think magically. They don't think logically. Children from 0 to 8 think egocentrically. It's to protect themselves, to make the world better. I mean, What is fantasy all about? Is to have a second world to do what? To repair the first world. Why do we go into fantasy? Fantasy can be very helpful, you see. In fact, I'm very suspicious of people who don't have fantasies. Because you can go into fantasy and make the world better. Because the first world is disappointing. The only problem with fantasy is if you stay there. And you can't get out of it. That's when fantasy becomes improper. But not to have any fantasy is really to have lost the imaginative powers, which also have curative powers. Temporarily, but it's curative. Okay. What's our time? We still have plenty of time. Okay. Any other questions about the gender issue in terms of separateness and closeness? I do not believe that these are gendered, genetic, biologically determined. But these two needs are needs that a person has. Somebody even said separateness and closeness are not needs. That is the self. And how the self negotiates it determines who the self is. Any questions or comments? All right, I'm going to move out of this to one other thing that I was going to do. And since I'm omitting one session tomorrow and I won't be here, I'd like to sneak it in today. And this is a word about legitimate narcissistic needs of everybody. We tend to think of narcissism as a perversion, as a pathology. Well, all of us come into the world narcissistically. All you need to do is watch a two-year-old, and you get a sense of narcissism. Narcissism really means self-needs. There is a secondary narcissism that becomes pathological. And this is the narcissism where one can no longer focus on anybody else but can only focus on oneself. That becomes pathological. But we all have self-needs. We all have three basic self-needs, and if these needs are not met, it causes problems for us. I want to mention them to you. We all have a need for grandiosity. Look, Grandpa, no hands. Right? When a child does something, accomplishes something, what does the child want? Recognition, right. The child was self-assertive, but what? Needs recognition of that assertion. Needs affirmation of it. That's what we mean by grandiosity. It's the need for mirroring. It's the need for you to reflect back to me who I am. You see, if you don't mirror back some things to me, I have questions about who I am. I still need you to affirm my sense of self. So, it's very legitimate to have admiration. It's very legitimate to be respected or to want to be respected, to be noticed. This is not pathological. To be praised, to be affirmed as one is. It's legitimate. I often give a client a compliment to test out the client, to see what they're going to do with it. What do you think most of my clients do with it? Negate it or just pass it off, correct. People, I know people with good self-esteem accept it. Thank you. I needed that. People with low self-esteem just pass it by. Or, you know, oh well, you know, don't know how to accept. Which is testing out this need, the need for grandiosity. They have the need, but they cannot affirm it. They cannot say yes to it. Because they've probably been told, oh, don't show off. Or you're making a fool of yourself. All you want is all the attention. So that was what? Mom and Dad got upset about it, so this need is bad. But it's necessary for every one of us. Second one is idealization. This is the need for merging with somebody else, for getting close. This is the need for touch, the need to be smiled at, the need to be reassured, the need to be soothed and calmed, the need to be empowered, the need to be included. Third one is called the need for similarity. This is the need for an alter ego. This means that I belong, that other people are just like me, that I'm normal, that I'm a self, that I feel self-enclosed, that I need a friend. All three of these are legitimate. Usually, we are injured in one of these three needs. Usually, if you want to talk about where our issues are, it's a lack or deprivation in one of these three needs. Either we feel that we are oddballs and strange, we don't belong, we're not normal, we're kind of odd and bizarre, and we're not similar. Or it's, I feel that I'm never included, no one soothes me or comforts me, I can't get close to people, or here, I don't get affirmed, respected, noticed, or mirrored. Now, anytime you get an injury in one of these three needs, if the injury is deep enough, you get some form of narcissism. And that narcissistic injury, when it's evoked later on in life, provokes rage in a person. And sometimes you may even recognize that all of a sudden, why did I have to handle like that? Why was I so rageful? Probably would give you a clue as to where your narcissistic injury is. What was it? Was it that you weren't praised, you weren't soothed, or you were depicted as being odd? Question here.
In the growing up stages of adolescence and all that, do you kind of go from one of those three needs in development into another? Or can you be deprived in some areas of each of those things?
You could have deficits in all three and they could be overlapping, correct? But generally, it's in one area that you didn't get it. But it could be that there was such ineffective parenting that you could be affected in all three. Now, again, I look at this less as the illness and more as tragedy. This is what happened. And now, as an adult, you know, I can't give power to the past, or I can if I want to, but the more I give power to the past, the less hope there is for transformation and for new life in the future. By giving power to the past means I keep blaming my parents. Okay. I keep blaming my situations. That this is irreversible. It can't be changed. It's there. The only thing that can be changed is you and what you want to do now and what you want to do tomorrow. And if you have some healing to do for some narcissistic injury, that's your task. Any questions on that? Comments? It usually is best to get healing through people. I don't like a lot of self-help books. I think self-help books can give you information that's important. Self-help book can give you awareness. I just don't think you get healing by reading self-help books, but they're useful. I think you get healing only in interactions and relationships with people. You only become whole when You have the two, self-assertion and recognition, held together. And that can only take place in community, in context. Because you begin to develop more self-assertiveness, more agency, always in relationship, not apart from relationship. And if it's to become more of a self-assertive person, it always has to be within relationship. Otherwise, you're going to go way over to distancing. And then you're going to wonder, why have I lost people? Why am I not close? Why aren't some of these needs being met? I often see some of the things that I do. At first, I didn't want to accept this responsibility, but I do reparenting. A lot of therapy is reparenting. And when I have a borderline personality, I have to spend time being very empathetic, giving that person space and time, and also to allow them to do some separating so that they're not so clingy. There are different ways to deal with different kinds of disorders, but I do a lot of reparenting. I have a pastor who's 36 years of age. His parents totally dominated him. He couldn't ride his bicycle off the property of his house. His parents told him what he liked. He had to go do potty right in front of everybody in the living room. See, no boundaries. All this is no boundaries. When he was 5 years old, his uncle used to pick him up and rub the little boy's penis on his belt buckle. In eighth grade, he was sexually abused by the PE teacher. He always then went into the world of fantasy, escaped. Right? He fortunately was able, there were a couple healthy people in that relationship that worked with him. But he is so unconnected to his sexuality. See, for a long while he thought he was homosexual. That's why these people did that. But that's not his orientation. But he doesn't know how to act or behave with a female. Just totally has no skill. Because he's disowned his sexuality. So the first thing he has to do is re-own his sexuality, his maleness, his masculinity, before he's ever going to have to learn any skills with a female. It takes time. The greater the damage or the injury, the longer the time. But I see people do it. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't believe in it. And it's not always through therapists either. Sometimes there are just some natural therapists in the world that know how to be able to help that person get that courage or strength to become more of a sense of self or get the recognition that they need and haven't been able to get. I have no magic formula to give you.
Do you find that in your going through your life that you kind of go in a, you repeat your cycles of growth, and you get to a certain situation or experience that will trigger you to go into regression and go back to these feelings of insecurity
Well, let me just say that on the way to progress and to change, you always regress. So I always tell folks, look, if you go back to old behaviors or old thoughts, that's part of the process. The key now is you're aware of it. Before, you didn't have the awareness. And once that painful genie gets out of the bottle, you don't want to put that genie back in. That's not to say you're going to do it with perfection, but you will regress to progress. That's why I said the first day, I will not take away anybody's pain. I take away people's pain. I take away their hope. I take away their health. I have to be able to tolerate other people's pain so they can grow. That's why I had to go to therapy, so that I could stay with my pain and someone could help me grow, so I could do that for others. Because if I wouldn't do it for myself, I wouldn't do it for you. I'd collude with you and help you to hide your pain. And, you know, in the church, unfortunately, we try to protect people in their sickness. We try to heal people overnight or in a weekend or in three easy steps, four spiritual laws or something, just, you know, to get them out of the pain. It's false. It's unreal. Now, there are times when there can be dramatic healing and things like that, but that's exceptional. We're too much a part of nature, which is seasonal, cyclical, and it just takes time. Yeah, you could fall back and so forth, but I think there are also times when you make certain steps and you move forward. Okay? I just want to list one more thing here on these things. How can you tell where your injury might be, in grandiosity, idealization, or similarity? Okay, the person who suffers from grandiosity is a person who's very, very concerned about his or her physical attributes. Bodybuilding. Slenderness. Beauty. People in grandiosity injured here are also interested in their sexual prowess. They're all gland. Or another one might be their intellectual genius. They're just powerful in terms of intellect. Or their financial success. In other words, some way that they get admiration, respect, praise, affirmation. Because they really are lacking, or had been lacked, good mirroring early in life. And so now they need this constant mirroring from others to feel important, safe, or good. In terms of idealization, these are the people who fall prey to omnipotent figures, cult-like figures. These are the people who have high sets of ideals or go into causes. They need to merge because they didn't get enough touching, soothing, including in the past. This is the drug culture. This is a lot of different kinds of movements. These are often people in parishes or congregations where there's a charismatic leader. A perfect match is a narcissistically deprived or grandiosity deprived pastor in an idealizing congregation. He needs the praise and they need soothing, so they give him all the praise and he soothes them like crazy. Gives him cheap grace and hot soup every time. Now, similarity would be when you always demand that others think, feel, or act the way you do. People who are set in the same way. That's how you can tell where the injury happens to come from. Okay, yes?
You said that you need people to get well. My father and my husband neither gave me what I needed. In fact, I gave myself away. And now I don't wish, I'm certainly not happy that he died, but in the last year I find that perhaps I'm doing a little healing of myself. It's the first time I've ever had freedom. And it seems like I'm able to do some healing on my own.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that's a result of having had those relationships. Even though they, as you said, they may have not have been as warm and comforting or as functional as you would have liked to have them to be. I don't think you could be doing the self-healing now if you hadn't been in those relationships.
Okay. I'm worried about the opposite end.
And the same way your parents screwed you up and so forth. And I've had that question because, you know, I see my children now growing and I see some deficits and I see some strengths. And I've dealt with that this way. I now know that they have my blessings and they have my failures. And they have my wife's blessings and her failures. And life's imperfect. I gave them what I had. You know, I can't take back. I could sit here and go into guilt and shame, whatever. Or I could just go into all pride, you know, and forget everything and become blind that they don't have to. But I want them to, you know, they're going to have to do the same thing I did, fight with these two issues in their life.
You mean there are no perfect parents?
Winnicott says that all we need is a good enough mother, and all we need is a good enough father, someone to help us get on the way to this journey.
One
or both, yeah, preferably both, it's helpful, correct. And I will say this, though, if you're fearful of screwing up your kid, you're probably going to do it. Because you're going to be very conscious of what you don't want, and you're going to be overdoing something. But this, again, just leaves me with one last comment, why, for me, it is so necessary to have the element of grace in life. I don't go with a lot of New Age stuff that says there's going to be everything's going to fall into place and convergence and harmony, etc., and you are God, God is you. I think that's very false. I think there has to be paradox and tension and contradiction in life for wholeness. You don't get wholeness by reducing the tension. You get perversion. You get distortion. And I think we Lutherans should be major spokespeople for this. You know, it's kind of interesting when I listen to people in psychology argue about different theories. One's on this side, one's on that side. Sooner or later, a Luther has to appear. Sooner or later, someone has to come in to introduce the element of paradox, tension. And it's okay to live there because that's where God's placed us. But ultimately, out of all that tension, there is a gracious one who resolves it all and brings shalom. I appreciate your attention and thanks very much.
Thank you.